Welcome to the Power Hour. I'm Adrienne Herbert, wellness coach, international speaker, and author. Each week, I speak to a variety of guests, from business founders to Olympic athletes, leading coaches, change makers, and innovators, to find out their daily habits, their rules to live by, and what motivates them to get up out of bed each day. Personally, I am on a mission to encourage, motivate, and inspire, so I hope that the Power Hour will help you to achieve your personal and professional goals. Hey everyone, welcome back to part two of the best of 2023 on the Power Hour podcast. So today we're going to hear from Sarah Knight. Sarah's advice is actionable, motivational, and no nonsense. Just the kind of advice that I enjoy. We're also going to hear in this episode from Dr. Pooja Lakshman, and she and I talked earlier this year all about real self-care. Not the kind of self-care that involves candles and face masks. Real self-care, what it really means to prioritize yourself and your needs. You're also going to hear in this episode from my good friend, Dr. Hazel Wallace, and we discussed the female factor, female hormones, and how the more knowledge we have about our own bodies, the more empowered we can be to make the best choices to maximize and get the most out of the different phases of our cycle. And last but not least, Dr. Alex George, one of the UK's favourite doctors, he and I sat down together in the studio in Shoreditch to discuss motivation, mental health, and gratitude. So let's dive in to this week's episode. The new book is what we're going to talk about today. And even the term adulting, I feel like a lot of people now are familiar with this term, this idea that, you know what, actually being an adult doesn't come with a manual and there's all these different things to navigate and it's really challenging. So I'd love to dive into it. I was really lucky to receive an early PDF copy of the book, which I thoroughly enjoyed reading.
Thank you.
I kind of just want to dive in straight at the top, really. So the first thing that I highlighted was the MO. So you talk about three words: maturity, responsibility, and accountability. Now, when I read that, I think I'll be honest, at first I wasn't, maybe growing up, I wasn't aware that these things were optional. However, when you meet people, when you meet people in the real world, and I'm sure we all have met people who, for whatever reason, they seem to think these things are optional and they don't take any responsibility or accountability for their actions, their behavior, their words. It just is bizarre. So I guess, why is it important for us to start there? Why did you start the book? Why is that the MO? Why is it important for us to start with these three words?
Well, I like to take the opportunity in all of my books to boil things down to their most essential ingredients because I want to make it as easy and pleasant as possible for readers to pick up what I'm putting down. So I actually did an anonymous survey before I started writing the book. I had hundreds of people respond to this Google survey about what adulting means to them and what they think are the most important qualities in an adult. And also, I said, think of somebody in your life who you perceive as a big fucking baby. What is it that makes you think that about them? So I had another list going on the other side of all of the qualities that do not make somebody mature, responsible, and accountable. And I sifted through all of that and, of course, my life experience up to my 44 years and really tried to boil it down. And I came to these three pillars of adulting. And the other thing that I try to do with all of my books is show people how to develop skills and how to achieve a mindset that will help them do a million different things. So Grow the Fuck Up is not a manual for adulting in the sense that I don't take you through the step-by-step process to do your taxes or the step-by-step process to change a tire. What I do is try to explain to you how being overall more mature, more responsible, and more accountable for your actions makes you the kind of person that understands this is what you need to go out and do, and makes you the kind of person who's capable of figuring out how to do it.
Yeah. And what would you say about these? Some people might think these are just embedded in certain people's personality, right? So they might say, and even I would say, depending on where you're born in terms of, in terms of whether you have siblings. So if you're the oldest, if you're the middle child, if you're the youngest, I think sometimes people will fall into these roles when it comes to being accountable or being responsible and taking on responsibility. But would you agree in the sense that these are not personality traits or characteristics. These are things that actually we can choose to be intentional about.
Oh, absolutely. We can choose and should choose to be intentional about them. And listen, I was very fortunate to be raised by two parents who instilled a lot of these values in me. They were both elementary school teachers for their entire 40-year careers. So, you know, I had somebody who was telling me to mind my manners and telling me to apologize when I did something wrong and clean up after myself. And I'm sure a lot of people did, but a lot of people didn't. And it's not anybody's fault if the good behavior was not modeled for you from a young age, but it is your responsibility once you are the adult and nobody is legally or morally obligated to take care of shit for you anymore. Then it is your responsibility to figure out how to do it for yourself. And so when I say that word responsibility, yes, there are a lot of people walking among us that are just big fucking babies. They understand the concept of being responsible. They understand the concept of hitting deadlines and being on time and being somebody that their friends and colleagues can rely on. But they just don't care. They don't want to do it. It's not important to them. And they don't care whose life it messes up along the way, including their own. What this book does is try to take the theoretical adults who do care, they do want to do well, they wish things were going a little more smoothly for them, and give them the tools with which to go all the way to the other end of the spectrum, which is the total fucking grown-up.
Yeah, you mentioned the questions, actually, the questions that you pose as well. And I even just reading those questions and kind of reflecting myself, I found that really, really interesting. And actually, I'd go as far as to say a little bit emotional. Maybe I was just in an emotional mood. But I read those questions. And yeah, I think the one that was asking me to think about what was the thing that you wish that your parents had taught you, or that you wish that I am a parent myself, but that you wish other parents would teach their kids. And so, yeah, I really liked those kind of self-reflective questions. And I think that even just taking the time to sit with these things and think about it is going to inform the way we act and behave.
I agree. And that's why one of the very first skills that we get into in the book is self-awareness. And, you know, I think that as part of that pillar of maturity, the first thing you have to be able to do is know yourself. You know, you can't go out there in the world and ask for what you want and expect to get what you want and need and communicate effectively to other people if you can't communicate effectively with yourself. And that's where maturity begins. It begins with understanding who you are, what makes you tick, you know, listening to your body and brain when they're trying to tell you something, and taking that information in, and then being able to react to it on a full spectrum. And throughout the course of the book, I make the analogy that, you know, an actual baby doesn't know anything. They don't even know how their toes work. You know, they can't be expected to be mature and responsible, let alone accountable for their behavior. But you, if you're old enough to be reading this book, you can. And one of the things that I think does get neglected in our adult life is that capacity for self-awareness, because we feel very reactive. There's a lot going on. There's a lot coming at us. If we're, you know, 20 years old, 23, 25, there's new responsibilities, big responsibilities. The older we get, maybe we become responsible for other baby humans. And sometimes it feels like we just want to skip over the self-awareness part because we have too much to do. But it's really, really important to start there and to ask yourself honest questions and answer them honestly so that you can go forward in life and get what you want and need.
Yeah, I wrote down self-awareness and underlined it twice to talk to you about, because I do a lot of keynote speaking and I go and speak to employees of organizations. And one of the kind of workshops that I do, it's not about like strengths and weaknesses, but more about likes and dislikes. Now, in this kind of workshop, I talk about self-awareness. Now, I can guarantee if I ask a room of 100 people to raise your hand if you think that you are self-aware, how many people do you think raise their hand typically?
They all do, I bet.
Every single person in the room raises their hand. Now, every time. Now, of course, not everyone can be self-aware, but everybody thinks they are. And I think that's the first problem. If we could accept, okay, I need to listen to what people are telling me about me. Maybe some of that is true. Maybe that's the first place to start. So how can people, if they think, okay, Adrienne, Sarah, I'm self-aware, like I am definitely self-aware, how can they stress test this to figure out if they are?
Okay, well, this is kind of silly, but it's a fun thing that my husband and I did and some friends did when we were whiling away the time during the pandemic. There are a lot of internet personality quizzes out there. There's one in particular, and I'll dig up the link for you and send it after, but it's like 150 questions, and it's all a sliding scale of, you know, one, I completely disagree, five, I'm in the middle, 10, this is me. And it asks you questions about yourself. And it takes all of this data and crunches it. And at the end, it tells you the fictional character that you are most like. And it gives you your top 10 matches and the percentage match. So when I took this test, my top match at the time, this was a television show I had never seen. So I didn't really understand what my top match meant. But I was self-professedly 97% match to the Dowager Countess of Downton Abbey. And when I told my husband that this was what I got on the quiz, he said, wow, not only do you know yourself really well, but you're willing to admit a lot of things about yourself that some people might not think were accurate. So when my brother took the quiz and my husband took it, and my husband's answers, I did not think were really that matched up with him. So what we did was we started swapping. And so like I took the quiz on my mom's behalf to see what I came up with for her, because I thought it was a more accurate representation of who she is than maybe who she thought she was. And so this is actually kind of a fun thing to do. You don't have to do it with a 100 question quiz. I just took another one on which Ted Lasso character you are. And by the way, I am Roy Kent and my husband is Keely. So I think that, you know, it's a fun way to you take the test. You can decide whether or not you think it suits you, but have somebody else take it on your behalf and see what they get. And maybe that's closer to how you present to the world. And if they don't match up, maybe you need to do a little work on self-awareness.
In 2020, in the UK's estimated wellness market size reached £12.4 billion. So this kind of tells me two things, I suppose, from a business perspective, the businesswoman head on. You know, I do a lot of brand consultancy, and it's quite clear to me that this industry is booming. It's probably increased in the last 2 years. And of course, some businesses and some brands and some organizations are making a lot of money selling us wellness. Now, I also think what it tells me is that people want to spend their money on things that they think and feel are going to make them feel good, even if it is short term. So I suppose, you know, when you mentioned that it's like consumer based and it's this idea that, like, of course, like, you know, a scented candle and a bubble bath, these things are not going to solve the root of the problem. And I think the downside of this is, of course, yeah, those fads and quick fixes and those kind of sometimes unhealthy and harmful products that were being sold. People might think, oh, this is gonna, yeah, this is what I need. This is the next thing that's gonna help me to change my life or to feel better. But then I suppose the upside, if there is one, eternal optimist that I am, is that if some of these products, if some of these services, if this kind of shift and focus to well-being is encouraging people to move more or to sleep more or to make some kind of positive change to their diet or their lifestyle, like, you know, I've read a lot of stats around Gen Z saying that they don't drink alcohol, like, you know, Gen Z and Gen Alpha apparently drink a lot less alcohol and they're much more focused on spending their money on experiences and travel rather than products. So I think there's probably, you know what I mean, like nothing's binary, like all bad or all good. But I think where the problem potentially is that it's often focused on the individual to say, okay, you have to, you know, figure it out yourself, you know, try these things, do this thing. Like, and we almost want, firstly, quick solutions. So something that, oh, I tried that for a week, it didn't work. You know, we want things to just be really quick. And also this idea that a lot of these things are, let's be honest, expensive. They're not accessible to a lot of people. So yeah, there's a lot to unpack in there. But what would you say about, I suppose, the downside and the upside, if there is any, and how we can kind of, I suppose, yeah, navigate the fine line between the two?
I really like, Adrian, that you use that word binary, because I think that really gets to the crux of what I'm trying to do with real self-care. I'm not trying to demonize wellness. And actually, chapter 2 of the book really dives into sort of the seduction that I'm talking about. And I am framing these quote unquote faux self-care solutions of like the bubble bath or whatever it is. I'm calling it faux self-care, not because it's bad, but because it is temporary and it's something outside of you. Mm-hmm. And in chapter 2, I talk about faux self-care as a coping mechanism. and go into the psychological reasons for why we really feel like we need that bubble bath or why we really feel like we want to go on the juice cleanse or whatever it is. For some folks, it's like you need that escape, right? You just need a second not to think, not to worry, not to have to deal with anything else. Or maybe you're somebody who's kind of motivated by achievement or productivity and efficiency, right? And so we turn to these different coping mechanisms as a tool in that moment that will quickly take away some of those difficult feelings, whether it's stress, whether it's low mood, whether it's anxiety. But what wellness has not done so far, so wellness has given us tools, and like you said, for many folks, those tools are not accessible because they're too expensive. But wellness still has not given us principles or perspective. And so that's what I'm doing in real self-care. I'm saying, okay, here's these tools, yes, but the reason that the tools feel so burdensome is because we're not doing that internal work on the principles to actually understand why. Why do I need the yoga class? What is the yoga class actually doing for me? So I like to say, you know, one person's yoga class can actually be just completely performative because, you know, they're worried about, you know, whether they can hold a headstand or not. And they want to make sure that they have like the right, you know, leggings or joggers, you know. That's performative. Whereas another person's yoga class could be real self-care because that person is doing the hard work of having, you know, the tough conversation with their partner to say, hey, I really, for my mental health, I need to go to yoga once a week, and doing the decision making of how to make that happen, being compassionate with themselves around giving themselves permission, right? So in that circumstance, yoga is actually really deeply nourishing. So it's less about the thing and it's more about the process that you take to get there. And so my takeaway or my whole kind of thesis with this book is that real self-care is a decision making process. It's not actually just one thing that you check off the list. No, it's just something that you need to bring to everything that you're doing in your life.
Oh, absolutely. And I hate to use the word intentional because I feel like it's become almost like, you know, it's like a tattoo now.
Yes.
But I do think that's exactly what you described, is that, you know, having understanding the why am I doing this? And if you can keep that front and center in your mind, then hopefully like the perfect example that you gave, you know, the reason for doing something and the reason for, I suppose, even having the cultivating the discipline or creating the time, because, you know, time is something that I talk about a lot on the show, hence the power hour. And often people say they're time poor and they don't have the time to prioritize these things. And I think, yeah, the real word for me is just being intentional, because it will require discipline. It will require some level of setting boundaries to create the space and time for you to do these things. So with that in mind, what are some other, you know, we kind of talked about what self-care isn't. What are some other, I suppose, things we should be considering, thinking about, practicing to really discover what true self-care is?
Yes. So in the book, I lay out four principles, right? Because we're talking about principles, not tools. And so the principles are, number one, learning to set boundaries and dealing with guilt. Because we all know that, especially if you're a woman, if you're a mother, if you're a parent or a caregiver, guilt is the first thing that comes up when you start setting boundaries. So that is step one. Step two is developing compassionate self-talk. So really looking at the conversations that you're having with yourself. And I will say for this principle, this one is the hardest for me. I've always been someone who kind of rolls my eyes a bit when anyone says compassion, like it feels very woo-woo to me. And, you know, you're letting yourself off the hook. And that's not the self-compassion I'm talking about. In real self-care, I'm talking about self-compassion in the way that Dr. Kristen Neff, who is a psychologist, who's really the foremost researcher on self-compassion, frames it, which is psychological self-compassion, looking at having new and different conversations with yourself. So it's about your relationship with yourself, essentially. And then the third principle is getting clear on your values. And I've created an exercise called the Real Self-Care Compass. And this is how you get to your why. Again, Adrian, like we were just saying, like your why, the reason why you're doing all the things on your to-do list, the reason why you're spending hours chauffeuring your kids around to all their activities, it feels different when you know why you're doing it. We can dig into this a little bit more, but like the why and the meaning, like that's the antidote to burnout, right? Like really understanding your specific values, and your values are going to be different than your best friend's values or your parents' values, or, you know,
and
your partner's values.
Change over time.
Exactly. They're going to change over time.
Yeah, sorry. I think that's the part often people miss, because whenever I hear people talk about, okay, discover your why or figure out your values, it's kind of this idea that you're gonna find it, you're gonna, you know, carve it in stone, and then you're gonna have it, and that is it. That's your value, and like everything has to be, you know, keep that front and center. But I think the most important thing is, of course, we have to commit to something, but then also being open to changing our mind, or accepting that maybe in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, maybe just 1 year, your values might change and probably have changed. And I think when people don't stop to assess that, they can kind of just almost become fixated, just like keep going on this path and beating the same drum, when it's actually, yeah, they need to kind of revisit that and go, is this still what I want?
Yes. So the concept that I keep coming back to in real self-care is called psychological flexibility. And this is a term that comes from acceptance and commitment therapy, which is a third wave form of psychotherapy. And essentially it describes what you're talking about, like being flexible with how you engage with your thoughts and your feelings, and being flexible with your values, and understanding that at any given stage of your life, I think the other piece is like, we all have multiple values. We all have like hundreds of values, right? But the priorities shift, things move up and down the ladder. As I was writing Real Self-Care, I was going through IVF treatments to get pregnant. And I had a miscarriage previously. And because of my history, you know, for a long time, I was like really ambivalent about becoming a mother. I didn't know if that was for me. And then I was fortunate and lucky that IVF worked, and I got pregnant while I was writing the book. And I talk about this in the book, and that in the section where I'm writing about values, like I was facing this too, knowing as I was coming up on this precipice of becoming a mother and knowing that my values were going to shift and being scared, right? Because I had built this career as a psychiatrist, as an entrepreneur, as a founder, and all of that work was done with the luxury of time and space for myself. And I was about to come up on this huge transition, right? So I think it's like, it's okay to not only, I think maybe what I want to say is that it's like okay to be scared when you're in those transition spaces, when you're in the in-between space, when you know your values are shifting, but you don't quite yet know what the next thing is. Also.
Yeah, absolutely. And also knowing how to prioritize them, because sometimes, as you said, we all have lots of things that we value. And sometimes when I've talked to people about this before, the struggle they have is kind of prioritizing, because they're like, well, I value my career, I value my family and my relationships, I value experiences and travel. And it's almost, again, this thing of how can people, I think they struggle to think if you just got to pick and stick, pick one thing, when actually, yeah, I think accepting that sometimes, as you described, and also, I mean, my heart was just so filled when you said that you had successful IVF journey, because as someone who's done IVF and knows how challenging that is, I was so happy to hear that you said, you know, that you were pregnant, and that, you know, congratulations on motherhood. But revisiting this, you know, values thing, yeah, just accepting that it's at different times and different stages throughout your life, it's okay for your value hierarchy to change. And what's the fourth principle? So we have boundaries, compassionate self-talk, values, and the fourth one?
Yes. So the fourth one is power. But before we dive into that, I want to just respond to one thing that you said about values and sharing. So a value actually isn't I value my career or I value my family. A value is something that you embody. So a value would be I value creativity. Or I value self-expression, or I value service. And so it has to be something that is describing something that you can embody. So And this is a really important distinction, because you can bring the value of, let's say, creativity to your career, and you can bring the value of creativity to how you parent, and you can bring the value of creativity to how you spend your discretionary time, in the little discretionary time that you have. So that's an important distinction. And I think people often conflate values and goals, right? And so it's important to always remember that a value has to be a descriptor of something that you can embody. So I just want to throw that out there. And for the real self-care compass, it's interesting because the goals are actually secondary. And as I was writing the book, you know, there was many goals that I put on my compass that I didn't get to, but because the value is the thing, right? That's okay. It doesn't mean that you failed, right? When you're following your values, then it can take you in lots of different directions in terms of where you end up. And I know for me, I've always ended up in the most fulfilling places when I was less goal oriented. But getting to that last bit, so power is the last principle. And really, it's the culmination of all three and gets back to the crux of why real self-care is so important and also, I think, revolutionary, because we are doing this internal work in the context of oppressive systems. So whether those systems are, you know, capitalism, whether those systems are white supremacy and racism, or patriarchy and sexism, the systems, as we talked about in the beginning of this conversation, when I was describing my patients, you know, the system is the problem, but you have to do this internal real self-care work in order to keep yourself whole inside all of these systems. And the reason that I, you know, as a woman of color, as an immigrant, or as my parents were immigrants, you know, like as this, like in acknowledging my place in the world, I think it was really important to me to sort of center the fact that there are so many folks who don't have access to the resources, to discretionary time, right? To childcare, to all these services that we all know are integral for mental health. So again, if you are somebody that does have some privilege, like for example, with my platform, like being a physician and being able to take the risks that I'm able to take, that means that you need to pour some of the energy that you have back into your community, back into helping others. Like with power comes responsibility, right? And that kind of goes back to the roots of real self-care. You know, we all know the Audre Lorde quote about how self-care is self-preservation. And like we have, you know, Black queer thinkers to thank for putting self-care in its most powerful form on the map, right? And so I think we just have to keep remembering that and not minimize it.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The end of December, actually all throughout December, I saw a lot of articles about end of year burnout, especially on LinkedIn. And I heard a lot of friends as well talking about this too. And kind of, I was actually in a sauna. I was in a sauna after doing a workout, and there was two ladies in front of me. I don't know them, but they were talking very loudly, which, you know, if you're in a sauna and you're talking loudly, come on. But they were talking about this, like, oh, you know, a few more days to push through and I've got to get this done and I've got to get that done. And one of them was a yoga teacher. So she was talking about, oh, I've got this many classes to teach, and just kind of, she said that her body felt broken. She was like, my body's exhausted, my mind's exhausted, I just need a week to just lay under a duvet because I'm so burnt out. And I just heard so many people talking about this end of year, like dragging themselves to the finish line. And surely that's not where we want to end up at the end of the year. So if anyone's listening to that and thinking, oh my gosh, maybe that yoga teacher from the sauna is listening, or anyone else, what could we do? And I guess starting now, what could we do this year to ensure that we don't make those same mistakes again, or fall into those same patterns and same routines that end up just leave us feeling utterly exhausted at the end of the year?
Yeah, I completely resonate with this. And I think our last conversation on this podcast, I felt like I was recovering from burnout. And I mean, even about 2 weeks ago, you and I had lunch, and I still had a bit of a breakdown over kind of past burnout that still, I think, still takes time to recover from. And as someone who's gone through it, it's something that I'm really proactively trying to support people from it happening too. Because it doesn't matter what job you work in, or whether you have children or not, or whether you work shift work or not, we're all at risk of burnout. And I think the most important thing is having boundaries between your work and your personal life. And that's easier said than done, because lots of us bring work home with us. Some people work on the weekends or work for themselves. Sometimes we work in really demanding careers that require us to kind of go the extra mile in order for us to climb that ladder. And I definitely have experienced that as someone who worked in medicine, in a hospital setting, where you kind of always have to be pushing to get up and continue to progressing. So learning where your boundaries are between work and life is really important. And also early recognition. So if you do feel like, oh, my body's broken, I'm not sleeping, I'm losing compassion, I actually don't enjoy my work anymore, they're red flags that you are, if not already, in burnout, and you need to kind of look at what's happening and how you can prioritize your health. And when it comes to kind of reviewing your schedule and prioritizing you over your work, again, I know this is easier said than done, and I've got people who will say, you know, I have to work shift work, I have children at home as well, so it's much easier for you if you don't have children, you work for yourself. But I would say, you know, review your schedule regularly and reduce or eliminate unnecessary things that aren't serving you. So maybe it's that you're saying yes to every social engagement, but you don't want to do every social engagement, or you're trying to achieve too many things at one time, and maybe you go through a season of doing one thing and the next season you focus on another thing, so you're not overwhelming yourself with too many things in your to-do list. And on top of all those things, like, the most important thing is looking after you, and that does involve getting enough sleep, exercising regularly, eating a well-balanced, healthy diet, and taking time out every single day, whether that's for 5 minutes of journaling, or it's a 10-minute coffee with your partner, or it's just going out and spending some time in the garden or walking the dog. But those little time outs help to center you and kind of take you away from, you know, your work day and whatever other stresses are going out. And also leaning on your professional and your personal support system, be that your colleagues, be that your partner, your friends, and putting your hand up when you are struggling and saying, you know, look, I'm in a bit of a tricky situation. I'm finding that I'm really starting to burn out and I just need to kind of get control. And sometimes it's really helpful to just chat it out and someone to say, well, you know, why don't you just do this or look at doing this? And I find that really helpful when I'm having a stressful time, just speaking to my partner about it. And then once I've said it out loud, I'm like, oh, that's the solution. I know what I need to do now.
Yeah, and also knowing that, I think I totally agree, when you speak to other people about it, it kind of validates it for yourself and also lets them know that you need support, because they're also there maybe in a few weeks' time when you're kind of back into it again, to kind of give you those reminders and say, hey, you know, maybe let's, I don't know, just go to bed early, or maybe let's not go out to that event, as you said. And actually, you know, you said about timeouts, you said daily. And I think for so many people, the idea of having a daily timeout, whether it's 10 minutes, whether it's a whole power hour, it seems impossible. You know, they look to the future and they say, oh, I'm going to book you know, I've got that week off coming up in however many months. And actually, I completely agree with you that we have to make it regular. You can't just keep going and going and going and going and hope that when you have that 1 week off, maybe in May, that you're going to, you know, it's going to fix everything. I think just trying to, even if it's not daily, even if it's 5 days a week, 4 days a week, creating some time and space to kind of break it up is so important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so hopefully there's some, yeah, got you thinking there about how you're going to approach creating a routine, things that we've talked about a lot on this podcast, exercise, sleep, you know, discussing with other people, mindfulness, all these things. It's not that we've never heard them before, but I think it's incredibly important to have reminders. And also, if I need to say it again, Hazel Wallace, Dr. Hazel Wallace, I feel like whenever things come from a doctor, it's far more impressive than coming from me. And with that in mind, the next thing that I want to talk to you about is a pretty big topic, okay? It's huge, huge topic. And firstly, I'll start by saying a big thank you to you, Dr. Hazel, on behalf of all women and girls. A personal thank you as someone who has suffered in the past for years with PMS, PMDD, fertility challenges and miscarriage. I really want to thank you for writing your most recent book, The Female Factor, because as I said, coming from a doctor and seeing the importance and the spotlight and the attention on this topic, which for so long I think has kind of been overlooked. It's been people roll their eyes, people talk about, you know, women's problems, women's issues, like they talk about it with a whisper voice, or they kind of say, just brush it under the carpet because we don't want to talk about it for lots of different reasons. It has been incredibly validating for someone like me with the challenges that I've just listed to read your book. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for saying that. Like, that's exactly the impact that I wanted to have with the book. And I think it's a really uniting conversation with amongst women, because it's such a taboo topic still. Like, women are still so underserved and overlooked when it comes to health.
Exactly. And also, I think it's important to note right now that this podcast, of course, has female and male listeners. Now, I'm sure that sometimes I have male guests, sometimes I have female guests, we discuss all different topics from finance to success to physical health to mental health, and it's for everyone and anyone to listen to. Now, this conversation is no different. And I think it's important to highlight that right at the beginning, because sometimes when people talk about the female factor, female health, women's health, men maybe think, well, this conversation's not for me. You know, this isn't about me. It doesn't, you know, I don't know anything about this stuff. And actually, yeah, it's not for me. So what would you say to any male listeners who might think that, yeah, that this conversation's not for them?
So the reason I wrote the book is because the male body has historically been the default body in medical research. And we just make the assumption that women are just smaller versions of men. And so this means that women are underserved, undertreated, underdiagnosed in lots of health conditions. And I think it's really easy to make the assumption that women's health is just to do with our ovaries and ability to conceive, when actually our health also includes all of the aspects that affect both men and women, our heart health, our gut health, everything, our brain health. And this is why I think the book is so important for not just women or people with menstrual cycles, but both sexes, all genders, because these things impact everyone. And if we're, you know, doing one group of people a disservice when it comes to their health, then it's going to impact other people as well. And, you know, I've got lots of men who buy the book for their partners, or they buy it for themselves to learn more about their partners, you know, whether it's supporting them across their menstrual cycle, through the menopause, through pregnancy. And, you know, like so many coaches and PTs who work with women to better understand, you know, how are our hormones affecting our strength and energy levels, or our nutritional needs, or how we sleep, or our mood. And there are so many things that we just don't fully understand, or we're just not told about. Because I don't know about you, but when I learned about puberty and what was going to happen, no one told me that, you know, I was going to feel bloated at this time of the month, or my mood might change at this time of the month, or I might feel really lethargic, or I might feel super energetic. And when I started to really understand that, and also I didn't learn about this in medical school either, you know, this is postgraduate education, self-directed learning that I had to go about and seek out myself. And as a woman, I found it so empowering, and it changed my relationship with my cycle and my hormones. And I no longer just view it as this thing that happens to me, but something that I can live in alignment with now that I understand what's actually happening.
I'm conscious we could talk about so many things, Alex, but I do want to talk to you about the new book, because you've written another book, and the Mind Manual, Mental Fitness Tools for Everyone. And we've started talking a little bit about fitness already. So I guess my first question for the listeners would be, if they see the cover, see the title, what is mental fitness?
Sure. I mean, I deliberately have used the word mental fitness because we often attribute physical health with physical fitness, something that we can work towards, that we can build, that can get better, that can make us stronger, that can actually help us in every area of our life. We literally just talked about that. Mental health, mental fitness is no different. You can work on your mental fitness. You can build it like a muscle. It can get stronger, more powerful, more capable, faster. And the effects are literally life-changing. And I think that's a mistake we really make. I mean, one of the things that I just wish we would stop saying as our mental health affects one in four people. Well, first of all, if you've got a heartbeat and you're listening to this, so I'm hoping you do have a heartbeat, you've got physical health. If you've got a heartbeat and your brain is working right now, you've got mental health. All of you have it. You're on that spectrum somewhere. Absolutely you are. And the thing is that your position at that spectrum isn't fixed. You're not one in four people on that spectrum. All of you on that spectrum, and your position isn't fixed. It's really important to grasp that, and it is so important for people that are struggling, because you understand that you can get to better days. But also, do you know what, let me be honest with you, it's also important for you guys right now that are feeling great and fine, think, well, I don't have mental illness, it's not a problem for me. Because you never know, the thing that will change your life and the thing that will come and bite you on the backside is not the thing you're probably worrying about all the time. It's the phone call on 4 o'clock at 4 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon on a sunny day, like happened to me, saying this person's died in your life, or this thing's happened, and suddenly your whole world changes. And you're, and for me, like, you know, this, and I'm referring to the time that I found out my brother died by suicide. I fell, you know, like falling through the sky, and you're trying to, you know, find your anchor points in the days and weeks following that. And I was very fortunate. I feel in many ways I wouldn't be here if I didn't have the understanding, the tools that I developed over the years of, like, right, I know that the fundamentals for me getting myself into anywhere near a better place are these things. Yeah. You know, for me, it was literally, and it still is as true now as it was then, the walk every morning, the 45 minutes to hour walk I do every morning, the cold shower that I get as soon as I get up in the morning, I have my cold shower, I go for my walk, my talking therapy, speaking to people, the sleep, all these different things, or having those tools is literally there to not only help you on the difficult or bad days, or even to save you in scenarios like that and try and get you back on track, but it's to maximize your life as well. We all want to live a happy life, don't we? Honestly, so just invest yourself in it.
Yeah, and I hate to interrupt, but this is exactly where I wanted to go with this, because you're so right. I think often the conversation around mental health and mental illness is that we only give it attention when it becomes a problem. So even if you think about, you know, our physical health, we're fortunate that we might not go to the doctor unless we have a illness, a complaint, something that's wrong with us. We might then go, I'm going to book an appointment with my GP. And I think that when it comes to mental illness and mental health, exactly that. It's that I don't, you know, I hope that many listeners of this show may be in a place in their life where they think, I don't have mental illness. They might not describe themselves as having anxiety or experiencing depression. Great. But it doesn't mean that, you know, often instead of going from not good to good, what about if we could go from good to great?
Exactly. And better.
That's, you know, what I'm all
we
about.
We have, the most precious thing that we all have on this earth, the most precious thing, and the one thing you can't get back is time. That's the most precious thing you have. You have this, you know, finite resource that you need to enjoy, that you need to, you know, achieve as much as you can in your life. And I don't mean achieve as like a success thing or a productivity thing. Achievement could mean literally finding contentment in your life with your family, with the people around you. That could be your sense of achievement. And actually, I would advise it's a pretty good place to start for most people. You know, it is life is about living and thriving and enjoying, and, you know, being in a position where you can put yourself outside of your comfort zone, that you can challenge yourself, that you can apply discipline so that you can push yourself to achieve things that you maybe never even dreamed of achieving. What I really hope for people, and what I want young people to see and believe and to understand as they grow up, is that, you know, you get one shot in life. And I know it sounds really cliche, but you really get one shot. So give yourself the best opportunity of taking that shot and enjoying your life. And, you know, fundamentally, you know, that book is written for everyone. You know, I really mean that, you know. And it's actually, talking of discipline, that's the Mind Manual 3.0. I've been through that book and I've torn it apart, and I've gone over it again and pushed harder and harder and harder to get it to where exactly where I want it to be. It's been, arguably, it's a lifetime in the making, and it's my experience together with all the science that's put in a way that's usable for people and genuinely can be used in day-to-day life. But, you know, also, the book really is there for anyone who just, you know, wants to get the most out of their life and their day. So don't look at that book, the Mind Manual, oh, that's for me if I'm struggling, or that's for me if I'm a bit meh. It's for you if you've got mental health, and you do. You've all got
exactly.
It. And you know, live a better life, live a happier life, live a life that you're, you know, less afraid. You know, I talk about a lot of things. People think, oh, God, that's odd. I've got a whole chapter on failure. My failure is literally your best friend. If you learn to fail well, damn, you'll be successful. You know, if you want to be successful in life, learn to fail. You know, it's like the thing of we talk about, you know, oh, there's no losers in a race at school. Why do we do that?
Oh my gosh.
Why do we do that to our children? You've got 10 kids racing, there's a first person, there's a last person.
Yep.
And it teaches them a lot. So the person that's winning probably learns the least, actually, because when you win, you don't challenge yourself and mentally or question or go over things, the reasons why you won, as much as why you failed.
Can I caveat that, though? Sorry, again, I'm interrupting you, which I hate to do as a host, but there's so much in
here.
Sorry,
I'm talking talk.
No, I'm jumping in, because we, oh my gosh, so firstly, I'm nodding my head because I definitely agree, and it's quite a divisive thing, and people say to me, especially as I turn up at the mum's race, and I'm not afraid to say that I'm pretty competitive at the mum's race. But back to the sports day, I think it's this, this analogy and this idea that, you know, there's a first and there's a last, and kind of taking that away and diminishing that, you know, people can't fail. And I'm not gonna say any more on that. The only caveat I'd say about the first place thing is that people, as you said then, maybe coming first, you learn the least. The only caveat I'd say about that is that for some children, in the school experience, especially, you know, here in the UK, they might not thrive in any other environment or on any other day. So they might not get an A, they might not get 10 out of 10 on the spellings, they might not be good at maths.
To celebrate achievement, absolutely.
Yes, that might be the only day
where they
actually
go, but it's celebrate. Oh yes, and we should use,
and
it's
great.
Exactly that point. So by saying that everyone's finished race, oh no, it's fine, you're taking it away from that person who goes, celebrate. And what I was going to say is really, really important, because people go, oh yeah, but that's really unfair and the person comes last. It isn't, because I'll tell you two things. First of all, the question it makes that person ask themselves, right, I came last, right, do I care? Do I care about this? If I don't care and I don't want to get better, I've already learned something from this, because this is not for me. I'm not into sports races. Maybe actually I'm into engineering. Maybe I'm into art. Maybe I'm into writing and music. Maybe I'm not. Why am I stood here on the sports pitch? I don't care about it. Or they go, damn, I'm last. I really care. Now I'm going to work so hard to get there. My God, that person will end up first. You know, I was that kid, you know, in a different way. I applied to med school the first time round, and I got my place, went through the application, got to do exams specifically in med school. There's 25 applications for every place, got to do interviews. It's hard. There's no getting away from that. I got my place at Liverpool, got to results day, and I missed out by my A grade in chemistry by 2 marks. I had 3 A's and a B. So my fourth A, I missed up by 2 marks out of, I needed 480 out of 500, I missed up by 2 marks. I was absolutely devastated. And they said, no, you can't come in, you've missed up by 2 marks. I had to question myself and say, what do I do now? My mum sat me down that evening and said, what are you going to do? Do you want to just take a clearing place, do something else? Do you want to scrap it, or do you want to go again? I said, ma'am, I really, really want to be a doctor. I remember sitting there and she was crying, we were crying. Said, I'm not giving up, this is not going to beat me. I'm going to do it. So I reapplied, I sorted out my coursework, I got a place, and I came out with a distinction for med school. So that failure made me genuinely question, do you actually care? And if you care, you already know now you've got to work twice as hard. And that is one of the biggest reasons why I think trying to make everyone appear they win all the time. You're stealing them. You're robbing children away from the opportunity of learning about how amazing failure is. Mm. You know, and when you achieve off the back of failure, because even if you are the kid that comes first all the time, you're not going to come first. There's always going to be someone faster than you, stronger than you,
yep.
and you're going to have to elevate yourself and do yep. better and challenge. You're going to fail at some point. And if you can harness failure, it's amazing.
It's
amazing.
Incredibly powerful hearing your story saying that, especially, you know, you sat down and went, no, I really want to be a doctor. I'm not going to quit. Mm. And do you think that partly your personality, there was something innate, because I often talk about this, you know, nature, nurture, because I'm probably a similar vein to yourself, whereas I'll set myself a goal. And if I fail, you best believe we go again.
yeah.
But some people, that isn't in them, and they failure can... It can crush them. It can make them think, you know what, I never want to feel this feeling again. And I'm never going to put myself out there again. I'm never going to step up to the start line again. I'm never going to feel this humiliation or this crushing weight of... And one failure for some people can define years of never, ever trying because they're so afraid. So, yeah, do you think it is like a nature... Like, where does that come from to see and experience a failure and for it to fuel you instead of destroy you?
And I think the sad truth of it is that in reality, a lot of people don't achieve their potential because of fear of failure. I had this professor when I started. I graduated in 2015. I started working at King's College Hospital, which was my dream hospital. And actually, when I was at med school, it was off tangent, but I used to have a printed picture of King's College Hospital, which people might have remember or have heard of as being one of the first hospitals with 24 hours and A&E, the show. And I had it printed and stuck on my wall because I'm a big believer. I love affirmation. I've got tattoos and stuff with different quotes. I love affirmations. I like things that remind me why it matters, and I look to that every day as I'm going to work in that place and I'm going to get there, and that really motivated me. But when I got there and I worked there, one of the first jobs I did was care of the elderly. It's looking after elderly people, and there was a professor there who was a patient, and he was at the end of his life. You know, we don't like talking about death in the UK for some reason. I tell you what, none of us get out of this alive. So I tell you what, you know, it's an odd concept really. That's a separate conversation. But anyway, he said to me, Alex, and he's a very, very smart guy, he said to me, Alex, I just want to say something to you. I just feel I want to tell you something as I'm, you know, sat here now and, you know, I'm in my final kind of weeks. He said, you know, I'm not sat here regretting the things that I did in my life, you know, with a very few exceptions. He said, I'm regretting the things I didn't do. And specifically, I didn't do because I was afraid. I was afraid of being embarrassed, of looking silly, of failing, or people judging me, or what people thought. And that has always really stuck with me. That has really stuck with me, because people often don't do things not because they don't want to or because they don't care, but because they're afraid. Mm. They're afraid of what people might think, their judgment. What if I look silly? Like, oh, I don't want to go and play guitar on stage because people might think I'm rubbish. You know, it's really, really sad. And I think so much of that is part of the narrative that we build in school, that, you know, everyone needs to be perfect. It's all about getting the top marks. It's all about, actually, you know, if you listen to some of the best, you know, musicians in the world, or it's the best sports athletes, you talk to Cristiano Ronaldo, which unfortunately I'm not able to talk to him. But if you were able to talk to Cristiano Ronaldo, he'd probably tell you, you know, how many times he's missed free kicks and done it over and over and over and over again to practice to get there, and accepted the fact that he's going to fail over and over. And I really do feel a lot of people struggle with that. But to your question, which I've gone around the houses answering, I think part of it is innate. Part of it is our genetics. We all have personality traits. If you look at a litter of puppies, they'll have different personalities from the very moment. You know, look at a litter of puppies, you can say that's a quiet one, that's a cheeky one, that's, you know. So I think there is that, but it is absolutely a huge amount of it is nurture. You know, my mum, as I grew up, I was diagnosed ADHD in my 30s, but I was definitely very different at school. School wasn't an easy time in many ways because of my ADHD, and I, you know, just wasn't diagnosed. But mum always used to say to me at night, she said, Alex, every night she said this, all the way to I was 18, which used to really annoy me as a teenager, Alex, you can achieve anything you want in life as long as you put your mind to it. And imagine, she said that to me every single night for 18, as long as I can remember, 16, 17 years, said that every night to me. It's going to sink in. And so I really do feel that resilience of, like, you know what, whenever I get pushed back, I push on. And I'm still like that now. I mean, you know, I'm trying to achieve stuff in government. I'm trying to get funding for the mental health space. There's loads of things I do all the time that I fail at, but it just makes me more determined. Yeah. I think that's very much like you as well. You're just like, no, come on, push on. But you can learn learn that. Everyone can learn that. You know, it doesn't matter you're 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, you don't have to continue repeating the same thing from before. Resilience can be built. the whole reason I wrote the book is because I believe people can develop. You can learn these things. You can expose yourself to through situations you can fail all the time. If you want to build resilience mentally and learn how to fail, go and do salsa dancing. If you've never danced before, go and do salsa lessons for 10, 12 weeks. Go and learn to sing. Do something so random you've never done before, and you'll build so much confidence in the fact that, do you know what, I went and did that. I had no idea. Tripped and fell over, but I got better. And do you know what? I'm still alive.
Yes. Oh, I love to hear it. And also as a mother, it's nice to hear, because I'll be honest with you, I feel like, imagine being my son. Imagine being my son, the things you must have to hear. And he just kind of, I feel like it goes over his head, and he probably goes, yeah, mum, I know. You can do hard things. Yeah, I know, in action. But because he's kind of used to it. But actually, that maybe you did
it
that.
Sinks
maybe
in.
Maybe
I did
you rolled
it the whole
eyes,
of my, the and... whole, I remember saying to my mum once, please, mum, you said that. And I used to go, I know, I can do anything. You can imagine 10-year-old me being like, I know, I used to do it every night. But do you know what? It worked. And yeah. I still, to this day, well, I'm 32 and it's still, yeah. I can put myself back into that bunk bed and hear her saying it to me.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to hear as a mother. So that is it for 2023 on the Power Hour podcast. Thank you so, so much, everyone, for tuning in. Whether you are a new listener of the show, whether you are a long time listener, I appreciate you. And of course, big shout out, big love to my wonderful producer, Jack Clariman. We'll be back next year with a whole bunch of fantastic guests and new episodes.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.